Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We were scheduled to have an interview live on the air right now with Brandon Herrera, the Republican nominee for the 23rd Congressional District of Texas. At the last minute, he dropped out of that, and so we have moved on. We hope to reschedule with Brandon Herrera and get him on the air at a later date. We do have scheduled Katie Padilla Stout, who is the Democrat running for the 23rd Congressional District, have her on tomorrow. So let's turn to the war in Iran. Today, the war with Iran appears to be in an intensifying, active phase. Things do not look like they're about to calm down. We are in the third week of the war that started on February 28th, when the joint U.S.-Israeli strikes were launched on Iran, and that has triggered wider retaliations across the region. Israel says it plans at least three more weeks of warfare focused on Iranian missile sites, nuclear facilities, and other infrastructure. Iran has retaliated with missiles and drone attacks, and the conflict has spilled into the Gulf and into Lebanon, including disruptions around the Strait of Hormuz and a vital oil shipping route. This matters far beyond the region, because this is now affecting global energy markets, shipping, and the risk of a wider Middle East war. So how did we get here? PBS Frontline has produced and is streaming an updated presentation of Remaking the Middle East from award-winning Frontline filmmaker James Jacoby. And James, welcome back to The Source.
It's great to be back, David. Thank you.
Well, thank you. So in your updated documentary, you take us through the timeline, tracing the road to war with Iran. We see multiple U.S. presidents resisting Israel trying to bring us into a war like this in the past, keeping those presidents decided not to do what we are doing now. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, for many decades now, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel has been in power in Israel on and off. And it's always been his intention to bomb Iran's nuclear program. He's been interested in bombing their ballistic missile program as well. And as you said, multiple U.S. presidents have resisted doing so because of fears of many different fears, but one of which would be the potential of a regional war. And so other routes have been taken over time, diplomatic routes. And then certainly President Trump has changed the equation as of June of this year, when he sent the bombers. And for about 45 minutes, U.S. bombers were over Iran and bombed the nuclear sites. And it seemed as though that was going to be the last of it, at least from the American side. But here we are, as you mentioned, 3 weeks into this war.
You're right. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you got a question or a comment for James Jacoby of Frontline PBS about how we got into this war. So to this point, though, about past presidents resisting Israel, Bibi Netanyahu's offer to join them in this war, it seems like they were reluctant to do that because of where we are right now. They did not want to get here. Is that a good assessment?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there were, again, it's complicated terrain always with the Middle East. And I think one of the things in the past, that the reasons that presidents were reluctant to get involved, is because Iran had been propping up multiple militias in the region, including Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, Hamas in Gaza. And I think that the thought was that if the United States and or Israel bombed Iran directly and went to war with Iran, then those militias would then be activated and either go after Israel itself or U.S. installations or bases in the region, or, as we're seeing now, close off the Strait of Hormuz, which is a huge artery for oil and gas globally. So, yes, I think that there was, now that those proxies, several of them have been kind of decimated. Maybe the risk profile appeared a little bit less risky to the Trump administration. But as we're seeing, I think, as you put it, David, this is the situation that I think multiple presidents wanted to avoid over the decades.
Let's go to a caller. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We have Jose, and Jose, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Okay. First, I'd like to say that I reject the PBS narrative that prior presidents have been reluctant to address the matter of Iran. Also, I reject the PBS narrative that we are attacking Iran because it is a state sponsor of terrorism and all that nonsense. All one needs to do is point to the Brookings Institute paper, Which Path to Persia? It's longstanding policy. The only difference here is that we now have a president who's willing to push the button, and for means of distraction from the Epstein files, he is compromised, and he's using this as an opportunity to divert from that, score a win for the Republicans in order to save the midterms. It's a cynical position that I carry, but however, it is played out through history, through time and history, and the PBS narrative is garbage.
Tell me, what narrative is it you reject?
Well, the PBS, when you watch a PBS documentary,
Tell me about this particular narrative.
I haven't seen it, but they've been consistent throughout the years.
Okay.
Jose,
we can't talk in generality. We're talking about a specific documentary and a specific narrative. But thank you for calling in. I appreciate that. So, James, Jose rejected the idea that Iran is a state sponsor of terror. How do we know that they are?
I mean, I don't. It's not something you can reject. it's a fact. Now, in terms of the president's motives for going to war, I can't speak to all of his motives, and I know that it's a popular narrative to say he's trying to distract from the Epstein files.
But no one knows for sure. No one knows for sure,
and that's not what we get into in the film because, again, no one knows for sure. And I'd like to say that we only stick to facts and speak to firsthand sources of people that have been involved over multiple decades with the issue of Iran. And I think that I asked Iranian officials themselves about. They don't necessarily call Hamas or Hezbollah or the Houthis state sponsors of terrorism. But when you ask Iranian officials about why they have supported these militias and these groups in the region, they'll tell you it's been to resist Israeli occupation, as they see it, of Palestine, and to resist the American and Israeli interests in the Middle East. And that goes back to basically the founding doctrine of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, that it was set up to basically resist the influence of what they saw as an imperialistic American and Israeli or Zionist movement in their region. And so, I don't think there's any debating as to the fact that they've given support to these groups, but the motivations for them, it differs by perspective.
In support, we're talking about funding, training, weapons, and the receipts are there. Iran says we did that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that it's been a major part of their foreign policy over the decades. They call it forward defense. So it's not a matter of whether. Yeah, of course there are receipts, and yes, it's training, it's coordination in some ways. Qasem Soleimani, who President Trump and in his first term assassinated in a drone strike in Baghdad, he'd been a major figure in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, was one of the architects of this kind of forward defense strategy that really.
So it's not up for debate. This is locked in.
This is locked in. And so, Okay. Yes, again, Donald Trump's motivations for this war, that's debatable. That's not locked in. That's not what we get to in this documentary. And I'm sorry to hear that he's commenting on a documentary he hasn't even seen.
All right, let's go to another caller. Let's go to Michael. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, thanks for taking my call. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm old enough to know back to 1975, looking at the process and the lack of progress with working, and then up to 1979, working with Iran or other countries in that area. And then I was thinking, and I just started hearing about the documentary, well, what was Obama and Biden's position? What were they... And historically, well, how did they handle this understanding of a terrorist state, and what could have they done that they didn't do?
All right, Michael, thank you very much. We know about Obama making a negotiated deal with Iran to stop their nuclear program, and that's a big part of the documentary, James.
Yeah, I think it's a terrific question. So, David, as you just mentioned, the pillar of the Obama strategy was the what's known as the JCPOA, which was the nuclear deal. And just the basic premise of that idea was that Obama had been resisting the idea that Netanyahu was floating of bombing Iran's nuclear sites. And Obama wanted to take the diplomatic route. He put together this deal, which essentially was to put in intensive monitoring and inspections to make sure that Iran essentially was never more closer than a year to a bomb or having enough enriched uranium to make a bomb. And the deal was criticized for a lot of legitimate reasons. One, it had sunset clauses. It would have expired, I think, in 2025, at which point Iran would have been free to do whatever it wanted. It didn't address things like the proxies in the region, like Hezbollah and Hamas and the others. It didn't address its ballistic missiles program. And so it's come under, you know, intense critique from people that it wasn't a strong enough deal. But the thinking at the time, and even talking to some of the Israelis at the time who were in the intelligence and defense establishment, thought in retrospect, maybe a deal was better than no deal, because no deal means war, as we're seeing right now. So the Obama approach was that deal. And Biden, when he came in, thought he could get back to the negotiating table with the Iranians. He sort of tried to sweeten them back to the negotiating table by offering some relief to sanctions enforcement. But as you'll see in the film, that really didn't go anywhere. The Iranians, from their perspective, weren't ready to negotiate. They'd already started enriching uranium to higher levels, I think, to get themselves a really good deal. And so it just sort of fell by the wayside. And I think you could kind of say that it was a bit of neglect from the Biden administration when it came to the Iranian issue. And obviously the October 7th and what happened after that, the Hamas attack really took over the attention of the Biden administration at that point.
And when the Obama administration, they struck the deal with the Iranians, and then they unlocked billions of dollars that had been frozen in accounts, the accusation is that those billions of dollars were funneled into Hamas and Hezbollah.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. And I did challenge Iranian officials on that, and they deny it. But the fact is that some of that money certainly did go toward propping up regional militias. And it's worth noting that obviously between Obama and Biden was the first Trump administration, and Donald Trump's first administration famously got out of the Obama nuclear deal, at which point Iran began to accelerate their enrichment of uranium. They also continued to build up their proxies in the region. And despite what was called a maximum pressure campaign, they probably made more progress during that administration than they had under any other, after Obama. So that's part of the legacy here. So when Biden came in, he was trying to get back to the deal that that Trump had brought us out of.
We're going to take a break here. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation with the frontline filmmaker James Jacoby, talking about his film, The Remaking of the Middle East. This is a documentary film that aired on PBS last week. You can watch it right now for free on YouTube. You can go to the PBS website, the Frontline website, and you can watch it there as well. 2-hour long. It just takes you through all the the channels, all the chapters, the negotiations? How did we get here? It's an important question we all have to figure out because we're in the middle of a war that is spinning out of control. 833-877-8255. More on The Source when we come back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to helping Texas communities and emphasizing safety. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit.
This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Right now, today, in the war with Iran, President Trump is appealing to America's allies, NATO allies, and beyond, even China, asking them to get involved in the war against Iran, trying to make the Strait of Hormuz safe for travel, for oil shipments to get through. He's basically inviting all these nations to the next world war. What are the stakes? How did we get here? And what can be done in order to de-escalate this before it does spin out of control? But how did we get here is the really big question, because you have an idea. These wars are easy to start, very difficult to end and walk away from. We're here with frontline filmmaker James Jacoby. He was a correspondent and he was the director for their latest film. It was called Remaking the Middle East, and you can watch it. So the full name is Remaking the Middle East, the U.S., Israel, and Iran. It premiered on March 10th on PBS, and you can watch it online anytime at pbs.org/frontline, on the PBS app or on YouTube or on the PBS documentaries on Prime. Let's go to a caller. Let's go to Robert. And Robert, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Look, I love my country like many people do. But don't want to give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt, considering the mess that this country's in so many other areas. You know, wants to take us back to the Jim Crow era. And you know, I have a problem with his credibility and his ability to guide his country. And look at the mess we're in this, war. He says one thing one day, says something else the next day. What's next? And I'm even afraid that this guy might even pull the nuclear button on us, and then what? So I'm not ready to give him any pass on this. And I think a lot of the country is already sick and tired of his lack of professionalism. Of himself and his administration.
Robert, thank you for your call. James, in your documentary, Remaking the Middle East, you show us that Netanyahu was in the Oval Office and he got a sample of Donald Trump's flexibility when it comes to crafting foreign policy in sort of improvisational style. And you showed us that, Netanyahu looked visibly angry.
Yes, that's a scene that was before the June attacks.
This is in April.
This was in April, exactly. When are you talking about recent April or
no, the last April?
Last April, great. Okay, cool. Understood. That was in April when basically, Netanyahu was really eager to put in place a plan to attack Iran's nuclear program, as well as other sites, military sites. They paved the way with some confrontations before that. And basically, Netanyahu had come to the White House thinking he was going to convince Trump to go ahead with it. And in front of reporters, President Trump basically announces to everybody that he was going to talk to Iran directly, start direct talks about having another nuclear deal. One that he hoped at the time would go much further than the Obama nuclear deal that he'd ripped up. And so, you see Benjamin Netanyahu sitting there in the Oval Office, completely dumbfounded and definitely upset because he was getting thwarted. And here was another American president saying, I'm going to go down the road of trying diplomacy with the Iranians, when basically no deal for Netanyahu was ever really acceptable. Now, that almost feels like ancient history at this point, last April, because then, of course, President Trump goes ahead and does bomb Iran's nuclear facilities in June. And here we are several months later, and we're at war.
That scene where we're looking at Netanyahu in the Oval Office, you could have put the theme song of Curb Your Enthusiasm over that, and it would have fit perfectly. Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Deborah. And Deborah, you're on the air.
Okay. I'm wondering why we feel like as a country, and especially our government, that we can have nuclear weapons and defend ourselves and have the right to do so, but we need to prevent other countries having the right to do so. And so I don't see where all this fairness that we always talk about, you know, comes into play here.
All right, Deborah, thank you for that call. So there is a theory that having nuclear weapons actually makes a country more responsible. But what would happen? Why the big fear of, North Korea has them, Pakistan has them, Israel has them. What's the fear of having Iran having nuclear weapons?
Well, it's a fear that Iran has, since the revolution in 1979, called for the destruction of the state of Israel. And I think the caller raises a really important question. I've seen it a lot in the comments on YouTube on the documentary. Of course, we mention in the film, more than mention, it's addressed, which is that Israel, even though it doesn't admit it, is a nuclear state. They do have nuclear weapons. So it is a question of fairness to some. However, Israel, at least not overtly, has never called for the destruction of Iran. Here you have a country in Iran that has called for the destruction of Israel. And I think the global community has come together, lots of states, both nuclear armed states and non-nuclear armed states, and said that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty should apply to Iran, that they have the right to have a nuclear program for peaceful purposes, but they do not have a right to develop nuclear weapons. And I don't think I don't want to make it sound like it's just the Americans and the Israelis that think that. It's the global community that's determined that. Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And they claim that they've been in compliance with it for a long time, and that they've been denied the right to develop nuclear energy, enriched uranium for peaceful purposes.
You framed the story, your documentary, as remaking the Middle East rather than simply looking at a war between Israel and Iran with the United States involved. Why?
I think that, the reason is because, obviously there's been something seismic that's changed, especially since the October 7th attacks in 2023, where obviously Hamas attacked Israel, but Israel saw it as an attack, not just by Hamas, because in reality, Hezbollah in the north also sent some missiles in the following days. The Shia militias in Iraq, which were propped up by Iran, sent missiles in. The Houthis have sent missiles in since then. So Israel saw this as an existential problem that needed to be addressed. So you kind of need to see this war, the current war, in the context of a post-October 7th period, when basically piece by piece, Israel has tried to decimate all of Iran's proxies in the region that they now feel grew too strong before October 7th, and they didn't do enough to address that threat. And so there's a new security doctrine that the Israelis are kind of living by now, which is that they are going to go after threats preventatively. If they see something that's threatening them, they're going to go after it. And so that is what this war is about. They see Iran as a threat. They saw that they had a ballistic missile capacity to be able to really hurt Israel and Gulf states, as well as American installations. And they said, why are we going to tolerate that anymore? They're not going to tolerate it any longer. And that's what this war is about from Israel's perspective. And I think Donald Trump has kind of come around to that same worldview, certainly of Benjamin Netanyahu, when it comes to preventative war here.
Mowing the grass, what does that mean, and how does that apply here?
Yeah, that's a good thing to bring up, because mowing the grass had been the strategy of the Israelis pre-October 7th, meaning that every once in a while there was going to be a round of violence where they'd send missiles and attack Hamas in Gaza. They called it mowing the grass because they just didn't want they didn't want these entities to get too powerful.
And it was
And so they,
routine, like you would mow the grass every couple of
yes,
months.
you could. It's an awful term, obviously, because in every one of these episodes, we can't forget that civilians die, and it's bloody and it's brutal. And it's just kind of a callous term, but that was the Israeli strategy toward these proxy groups. They were less inclined to do it towards Hezbollah over the years because Hezbollah was always thought to be the big threat. Of course, they're in southern Lebanon, and they had a huge arsenal of missiles that were pointed at Tel Aviv and into Israel. But Israel has basically had their way with Hezbollah after October 7th. Of course, there's the famous pager attacks. Those get a lot of press, but there was a lot more that Israel has done to kind of decimate Hezbollah's leadership as well as their missile capacity. And as we're sitting here, Israel is bombing in Beirut and southern Lebanon, still going after Hezbollah targets and still wreaking havoc for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of civilians who are caught in the crossfire.
Yeah, and so the question is, how long can they keep this going on? 3 weeks is what we're hearing right now, but they may not have a choice. They may not have an option. That this could continue to unfold and bring in other players into this developing, expanding war. If you've got a question or a comment about how we got here, we'll take your call. Ask your questions. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, Frontline, Remaking the Middle East, the U.S., Israel, and Iran. It's available to view on YouTube, PBS Documentaries on Prime. Source continues after a 1 minute break. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. PBS Frontline is produced in a streaming presentation of Remaking the Middle East from Frontline award-winning filmmaker, correspondent James Jacoby. They really dig into how we got here, the conflicts between Iran and Israel. And so, James, I want to ask you about your film also looks at the conflict with the Palestinians. Why was that essential to telling the story of the war with Iran?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Iranian Revolution also, I've spoken about it a bunch here, David, was also organized in some ways. One of the founding tenets was to support the Palestinian resistance against what they saw as the occupiers. And so it's been since the revolution, an important part of the revolutionary ideology to support the Palestinian resistance movement, and basically to arm groups like Hezbollah and Hamas. Hamas is a strange bedfellow for Iran. They're Sunni Muslims, not Shia Muslims as they are in Iran. Yet they have been obviously mounting an armed and violent resistance to Israel for decades. They have also violently opposed any sort of attempt for a two-state solution for decades, and any peace accords whatsoever, really, with Israel, and have been dead set on the destruction of Israel for decades. So it's a central tenet, and it's interesting to note that as a lot of the other states in the region, Arab states in particular, have moved toward normalizing relations with Israel. And kind of sidestepped the Palestinian issue as there is no Palestinian state. Iran has kept up its support for groups that are still fighting against Israel and its very existence. And I think that's really important to note. So, it's all wrapped up together. And, there's been so much necessary focus on the war in Gaza post October 7th. What I felt was missing from the conversation was how that fits together in terms of the Israeli war in Gaza, how that fits together with the larger piece of Iran and the so-called axis of resistance that they developed over around Israel.
Do you think what's happening right now with the war with Iran, that we have crossed the event horizon? That's the point where you get to a black hole where the gravitational pull is so strong you can never get out, you can never pull away from. That we have crossed the point where things are going to dramatically change in the Middle East. Something is going to give.
Well, I'm very concerned that we are at that point. I don't know, you know, I don't know regionally where we are going to be in the Middle East, but I don't know about our exit options from this war right now. I think there are massive risks attendant with either getting out of this war or staying in it. And it just doesn't seem to me like any of the options is great right now, unfortunately. This war, I think it's important to note, is and can't be overstated, is, you know, as David Sanger from The Times tells me in the film, is a war of choice. There was no evidence of an imminent threat from Iran to either the United States or to Israel. And we've entered a situation where by going to war with Iran, we may have opened Pandora's box.
You know, it may have been a war of choice, but the way your documentary unfolds, it looks like a war that was inevitable.
I mean, I mean, it's interesting. I think it was inevitable that Israel was going to attack Iran at some point. I don't think it had to be inevitable that the United States joined that war. I think that one of the arguments that Marco Rubio and others have put forth has been that, well, you know, and I think Benjamin Netanyahu did say this to the president when he's visited the president before this war, saying that, well, if Israel attacks, then Iran's going to retaliate and go after U.S. assets or allies in the region, and therefore the U.S. is going to get drawn into the war, so you might as well join us at the beginning as opposed to getting drawn in 12 hours later. But I don't think there's anything inevitable about any of this. I think these are choices, unfortunately, you know, we are in a situation now that this choice has been made that I don't think there's many good options in terms of an exit.
But when this is over and done with, the remaking of the Middle East, we will have a different Middle East.
Yes, of course, in some ways, I think there's an attempt to remake the Middle East. This is all part of an attempt to remake the Middle East. Again, put it in the context of post-October 7th, 2023, Israel has been leading the charge to try to remake the Middle East. You have Gulf states that are defending themselves against missiles and drones coming in from Iran. We don't know how this remakes the region. And of course, this is all very high level. You also have all sorts of realities on the ground and complications in the Middle East that haven't been solved yet. The Palestinian issue hasn't been solved. Clearly, Syria, Lebanon, there are so many issues. And you also have just all the socioeconomic and political problems that have nothing to do with this war. Environmental problems, yes. You've got major swaths of the region that don't have access to good water. I mean, there's all sorts of issues in the Middle East. So will it be remade? Yes, of course. But in what fashion and who's leading it? And are there any political solutions on the horizon? Who's talking? What does a peace look like? It really is all up in the air right now.
James Jacoby, he is the correspondent and the director of Remaking the Middle East, the U.S., Israel, and Iran. It is available to watch on YouTube and on the PBS.org Frontline and also at PBS Documentaries on Prime. Thank you so much, James.
Thanks. Always a pleasure to talk to you, David.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.
My name is Jasmine Garst, and I'm an immigration correspondent for NPR. Covering immigration right now is extremely challenging. A lot of the people I'm interviewing are hiding because they're too afraid to go outdoors. Something that I have really tried to focus on in my work is the humanity and the nuance and complexity of every human being, whether that is a 12-year-old girl trying to live her life in Minneapolis or a farmer in Florida. I think that we're at an inflection point in which we're really questioning our identity as a country, what we're okay with and what we're not. And that's something that I think is going to be a really big story this year. Your donation supports journalism that gets to the heart of the story. Please give today, and thank you.
The number to call is 800-622-8977. Go online to tpr.org, or you can use your handy-dandy TPR app. Become a sustaining member of Texas Public Radio right here, right now. I'm David Martin Davies, and this is the Texas Public Radio Spring Fundraising Drive. Independent journalism, that's what you're getting right here, and it only works when communities support it. Independent journalism from things like PBS Frontline, you know, and here at Texas Public Radio. TPR answers to listeners, not advertisers or agendas or billionaires. That independence allows our reporters to investigate, explain, dig into complex issues, take risks that other people won't be willing to take, and tell the stories shaping South Central Texas and beyond. We have a goal. We got to raise money to keep TPR strong, and you are the person who's going to help us do that. Give us a call right now. We got to get there. We need your support. This is not a time to shirk. This is a time to step up. 800-622-8977. With me in the studio, Camille Phillips, our brave, fearless education reporter. Camille.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being part of the TPR family. And part of that is donating to Texas Public Radio, because we are listener funded. We are community funded. We don't exist without you. We have a challenge right now to raise $5,000 by 3 p.m. And we are about halfway through, a little more than halfway through. Sorry. We have $1,584 left to go. So that is very doable. I'd love to see us finish that challenge early. And when we meet that goal, we will get a matching $5,000 from some loyal supporters. So now is the time to give. Your money goes twice as far, and you can know you're supporting something you value. I want to thank Michelle McMurray for your support of Texas Public Radio. We also have a Wendy Reeves of Burnett. I think I thanked you earlier, but I'll thank you again. Thank you so much. Marilyn Garland signed her dog Penny up as a member and increased her personal sustaining membership. So thank you, Marilyn. Thank you, Penny. Join them. Why don't you? This is something you believe in. Independent journalism that is not beholden to anybody but you, our listeners. 800-622-8977 is the number to call.
Well, let me explain what happened with the Brandon Herrera thing. We had scheduled him to be on the first half of The Source today. We had been emailing back and forth. We had a phone conversation with his campaign manager this morning. They confirmed that they would be here in studio, and everything seemed like it was locked in. And then 15 minutes before showtime, they called us back and they said something came up and they're not going to make it. This is something that you dread when you are going to be hosting a live public radio program and you have a guest set up. And, you know, we promoted this. We thought we were going to be doing a great public service. We wanted everyone to get a chance to hear directly from him. He has been saying that taking the videos that he made on YouTube, they're being taken out of context. I wanted to ask him about that. Well, what is the context? These are videos made for entertainment. Should, you know, is it fair to use them in trying to figure out who you are? Well, tell us who you are. Mm-hmm. We're going to give you an opportunity. This is unedited. You will not be edited. This is unfiltered. This is going to just be you talking to the people and to the voters. Hopefully, we're going to be able to reschedule. Tomorrow, we will have the Democrat in that race, Katie Padilla-Stout. Looking forward to that. But this only happens because of you. Support Public Radio, 800-622-8977. We can't do it without you. Doing the work that you want. Thank you.